Welcome to Book Talk. I'm Alan Farley, and this week it's all about the movies. Stay tuned. Joining me now is Dennis Willis, here with his book, Flick Nation, his 2010 movie yearbook. Welcome to Book Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, now, this is a book about recent films. This is not a compendium of all of the greatest films of all time, but...
No. I haven't seen all the greatest films of all time. But I do reviews on the radio, and I have for the last 10 years or so. And a good friend of mine is John Stanley, who hosted Creature Features for me.
Yeah, he wrote a very nice introduction to your book.
He did. John is a wonderful guy. And it also should be pointed out, he edited this book for me. Just a great, great guy. A wonderful mentor, great friend. But he has these Creature Features movie guides that I've seen and bought and gotten from him over the years, and I thought, I would love to do that. And so, as you know, when you write radio, you tend to write in bullet points, and so I had years of reviews written in bullet point form, and I thought, well, let's see how many I can put together. And actually, I realized when building a list of about 500 movies going back about 3 years, it occurred to me that if I'm going to do a definitive list, I'm about 100 films light. And I need to watch a lot of films. And so last year, between March and June, I caught up on all those movies. And boy, that was that was something. People would ask me, what have you seen today? I don't remember.
Well, I'm at a real disadvantage. And for one reason is that lately, the last few years, I haven't gone to many films. I mean, I've probably seen like half a dozen films in the last couple of years.
You can consider yourself lucky there.
Well... But how do you do it?
Well, you know what's interesting, and this is something I wrote about in the book, and I say to people when I get up in front of crowds, one of my favorite subjects is how people go to the movies, and that's most of us, average people with jobs and lives and kids, they see a movie every few months. If you're a little more active, maybe a movie a month. When I was younger, I saw a movie a week before I got into all this.
Yeah, I probably did too.
You know, and what's the criteria? The criteria is, what am I in the mood to watch? I've had a long week. I'm paying the babysitter. I want to have a good time. And so we pick the movie based on, I don't want it to be political. I want to watch stuff blowing up. I like that actor. I don't like that actor. And when your job is to create, you know, critiques of these things, you got to watch 3 to 7 or more movies a week. And so that's when you usually spot the seams. You know, they say critics are grumpy. You know, we just want to have a good time, too. But when you see the same romantic comedies over and over, you see the same actors phoning in the same lazy performances, you look for that breath of fresh air. You know, you look for, you know, and that's why things like Jim Carrey can come along and do a dramatic performance. And it's a breath of fresh air seeing him in a movie like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It's like, wow. I didn't know he had that in him, you know? And so those are the films I tend to champion, the ones that are such wonderful surprises.
So would you put Monique in the Precious in that same category?
She was superb. I had a few problems with that film in terms of the directorial style, a touch flashy for the kind of movie I thought it was trying to be. You can't take it away from the story and the performances, though. It was just she won everything, and deservedly so. It was just one of the great performances of the past decade.
Well, now, there's a lot more in your book than just the capsule reviews of the films. Yeah. I mean, there's a long introduction with your thoughts on criticism and on audiences and on films and the way films are shown and remade.
Yes.
There's so many topics here we could touch on.
I figured, you know, I'll write a piece that it kind of touches upon a lot of things that I think about. I kind of geek out on things like this. I find the business aspect of the entertainment industry a lot more interesting than who's dating who.
Well, I know that you put the gross of the film in here as well, which is unusual for books like this.
It is, because I think a lot of times there's a real discrepancy between the movies that are the popular films and, in a lot of cases, the movies that are the good films. I mean, you take The Hurt Locker winning Best Picture. Nobody saw it. Well, that's not the fault of the film. It's the fault of the distributor only putting it on a handful of screens and releasing it the wrong time of year. So to see a movie like that break through and have enough people see it to, you know, so it wins Best Picture, that's lovely.
Yeah, what do you think of the expansion to 10 films for the Oscar nomination for Best Film? Because you were, when you wrote the book, it hadn't yet happened, but it had been announced.
Right. I You know, I'm not opposed to it. I think, on the one hand, it weakens the category to the degree where, well, you know, now we have all this other stuff. But otherwise, Up got in, and District 9 got in, and these other films got in that I think otherwise wouldn't have. And I think that a lot of genres, science fiction, had a great year last year. Animation had a great year last year. And those are the films that traditionally get left off. I mean, in 2008, as you read, The Dark Knight and WALL-E, the Pixar film, were huge, critical, and popular hits. And I think it was just the general assumption that those two films would defy the stodgy drama curse of the best picture. And those would get in. It would have been very exciting. And then they didn't. And everybody got mad. And you kind of have to question, you know, well, should Doubt have been on that list when people are going to be talking about, you know, WALL-E and The Dark Knight in 20 years? And that's when they expanded to 10. And in the end, it was still a horse race between two or three movies. You could have a 50-movie Best Picture list. So if it exposes, I'm not opposed to it if it exposes people to good movies, which I think it has.
One thing I find, it seems to me it's sort of what we've got. If you've got 10 films nominated, then why not 10 directors? Why not 10 actors, 10 actresses?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Because traditionally what happens is the picture and the director will match.
Frequently, very frequently.
Right, right. And in this case, not so much.
Except that they did.
Except that they did, yeah. I think when you're talking about five directors, it's almost a given having 10 films that all of them are going to make it onto the list. I mean, there has to be a real disparity.
Yeah, it always puzzles me when someone who mm-hmm. makes the best film, quote unquote, isn't even nominated for best director.
That's true. I believe, and don't quote me on this, but I think that happened with Ron Howard. And I think he might have won the Directors Guild Award that year, but not pulled down a nomination at the Oscars. And yet Apollo 13 was nominated for like 10 Oscars. So it happens, maybe less now.
Well, what was the process of putting this book together, taking your bullet point capsules and expanding them and
it was a long
something
process.
More readable?
I sat in front of my computer for months, but, you know, I watch. It was okay because I have two screens. I do a lot of video editing, and so I'm used to working two screens anyway. I literally watched movies on this screen and wrote reviews on this one and had the internet open at all times and researched as I went. It was just this kind of information gorge, and like I said, it's very easy to forget. I was I mean, when you take in that much information and just kind of and regurgitate it out, it's easy to forget. And so I was at Thanksgiving at my in-laws, and my wife's aunt said, I really love this film. It was a French film, and she mentioned it, and I can't think of the title now, but she says, is that in your book? And I looked at her and I said, I don't know, let's see. She says, oh, come on, how can you not know? It's like, well, there's 500 movies, you know?
We're talking with Dennis Willis about Flick Nation, his compendium of capsules of recent films. Now, one of your favorites is Dark Knight. Well, I guess you thought that was the best film of 2008.
It was certainly one of them. I liked it a lot. I thought that it was... I love a film that defies... It takes your expectations and uses them against you. And the one thing that Christopher Nolan came from, he was an auteur. I mean, he made some amazing films that were not studio driven. Memento and I can't think of the name of that one either. The one he did right before Memento, and Insomnia. And so here's a guy who he got his hands on the Batman franchise. And I think the best studio films now are being made by these guys, these people who were auteurs, writer-directors with very strong visions, very strong visual aesthetics, and turned loose on an established product. And what he did is he grounded the whole thing, took it right down, made it look like and feel like Chicago. And this was a Batman movie and asked big questions about who we are as people, the nature of good and evil. How far can you bend a man before he breaks? And I thought, wow, those are some big themes that you usually get in war films or dramas, and it was a Batman movie. And so anytime you can take a genre's expectations, defy them, and work beyond them, I'm a huge fan of that.
You also said you think that 88 Minutes was one of the worst films of the last decade.
It was hysterical. It was one of the best comedies. Didn't set out to be that way, but...
Well, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen most. In fact, in this year, I think I've only seen two films: The Fantastic Mr. Fox and A Single Man.
Loved them both. Yeah, loved them both. I've been catching up on my Oscar films. I just saw Crazy Heart about a week before.
That's one I'd like to see. It sounds like it's a great film.
Wonderful, especially when you consider that the fellow who made the film, it was his first movie. And to get that performance, I mean, Jeff Bridges, I've always been a fan of. Fearless, shot here in San Francisco, 1993. Tremendous movie. And it was largely ignored at the Academy Awards and largely forgotten. I mean, even the DVD is just kind of one of those low-rent pan-and-scan DVDs. And it's like, why doesn't that... That's a Peter Weir movie. Why does that movie not get more love? But Jeff Bridges has been turning in tremendous performances for 40 years. And so I'm so glad for him, but he earned it here. Back to Al Pacino with that 88 minutes. He won for Scent of a Woman, and the consensus was at the time, and I think now, that Al Pacino just needed to have an Oscar. They didn't give it to him for The Godfather or Dog Day Afternoon. They gave it to him for Scent of a Woman, and I was a little afraid of that. I thought, uh-oh, Jeff Bridges is going to phone it in and win. But what a performance that was, and the movie was just wonderful.
Thinking of sequels and remakes and reboots and reimaginings, et cetera, I mean, certainly the Godfather series was one of the best, and two of the best sequels ever.
Sure, sure. The third one gets bashed a lot. But see, and then I thought Pacino was tremendous in that third Godfather film. It's not really popular to say you liked it, and it was a bit rushed, you could tell. I think Coppola's later edit of it was a lot tighter. But yeah, what a tremendous series, and wouldn't it be terrible to see a reboot or a remake of The Godfather?
And
yet everything's being touched. I think if it's got a brand name, that's the bottom line. If it's got a brand name, if you could stick it on the side of a toy, they're going to remake it at some point. And it's just, that's right there. That's corporate thinking.
Well, now, what's your favorite way to watch a film, or does it depend on what kind of film it is? That some films you can watch at home on television, others you might rather see in a theater.
It's a good question. I don't really have a favorite way. Some movies like seeing Star Trek last year on the big screen was wonderful, and certainly movies that are more visual lend themselves to that. But then again, the rub is that if you've got a film like Transformers, which I don't know if you've read my review, but that movie made me want to hit somebody when I was done. It was 2.5 hours of noise and clutter. Okay, it looked great. And on the big screen, you get all that great digital detail. But I think that film for me on a TV across the room where I could have gotten up and walked out a few times, I think might have been I would have been kinder to it.
What's your take on an Avatar? I've talked to a couple of people who saw it and just thought it was a terrible film.
Well, you know, the knock against Avatar is that it's really Dances with Wolves. It's Pocahontas. It's the same story.
Mm.
I didn't let that bother me so much because I thought it was the best 3D I've seen ever. I think that James Cameron is a latter-day Cecil B. DeMille. I mean, the guy makes huge, entertaining movies. And crowd pleasers, you can't take that away from him. And you look at an Avatar versus, say, a Transformers movie. Transformers, loud, cluttered, obnoxious, meant to sell toys. Avatar, sure, it was a familiar story, but it had a heart, it was well told, it moved. 2.5 hours, I wasn't bored. Visually, it took me to another place. And when a movie can transport you that way, you know, a lot of the Oscar fallout, they're saying Hurt Locker versus Avatar, and Avatar clearly was the most popular. And the analogy is this going to be like 1977 when Annie Hall won over Star Wars? How Star Wars was the one that really impacted pop culture more than anything else.
And yeah.
I don't think that's an apt description because I think Avatar, once Avatar's gone, I don't think that we're ever going to remember it as fondly as we did Star Wars. I would vote for Star Wars to be retro best pictured over Annie Hall. But if you look at Avatar versus Hurt Locker side by side, Hurt Locker is clearly the better film.
We're talking with Dennis Willis about his book Flick Nation and movies in general. What was it? How'd you get addicted to movies?
I don't know. I I grew up watching cable channels here in the Bay Area. And in late 70s, we got our cable box, and it came with movie channels, and they were unscrambled. And I always loved films. For me, it was, you know, I was a Star Wars kid. I grew up watching Flash Gordon serials with my dad. I was so pumped and ready for Star Wars that when it came out, it blew my mind. I was 10 years old.
I remember that event of seeing going to a screen of Star Wars at the theater on
the Coronet
Theater.
Yeah.
Was just mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen anything like it.
Exactly. And so I got interested in film as a medium. I think I was 11 or 12 years old. I was collecting the trading cards from Star Wars, and they'd run out of pictures, stills from the films, and they started showing behind-the-scenes images. And there was a shot of Luke and 3PO up on the mountain looking down with the binoculars, and it was them on the hill. And I'd seen the movie 10 times in the theater already. And they were surrounded by this crew, and with the windshields and the microphones and the light. And I thought, wow, I never even considered that something happened outside the frame. And so the next time I went to go see Star Wars, I was totally aware of what was happening outside the frame, which got me interested in how stories are told and how movies are constructed. And I began watching everything, foreign movies and independent movies, and even while I'm a teenager and my friends are watching slasher flicks, which were great if you're a teenager, and I liked them too, but then a movie like Chariots of Fire wins Best Picture, and I needed to know. I remember dragging a friend to go see Chariots of Fire. Well, it won Best Picture. It's got to be good. My friends were bored stupid, but I wanted to know how that movie, why that was considered a good movie. I think that's always kind of interested me.
So when did you get a chance to start expressing your opinion to others?
Well, my family bought a video store in 1986, and my dad and I kind of ran it. And a guy who I've ended up having a great creative partnership with, Steve Kirk, he and I both worked at the store, and we watched a million movies on VHS tape and talked about them all the time. I mean, it's kind of the Quentin Tarantino thing, you know, so we were immersed in it all the time. I kind of fell into reviewing movies by accident, because I'd produced a public access music show in Pacifica. And one night in my video store, a gentleman named Steve Wagner walks in, and it's all of this is his fault. He's a great friend. But that night, I had no idea who he was. By the end of the night, we agreed to produce a Siskel and Ebert-type review show on this public access station. And as it went, over the next 5 years, we took the show to satellite networks and ultimately to KGO-TV, and the idea was pitched that to help promote the show on KGO-TV, that one of us would go upstairs and do radio once a week to talk about the films. That ended up being me. So I didn't set out to do this. I kind of fell into it, but I loved it. And the show got canceled quickly. There's another story there.
The TV show.
But the radio bond held, and it was just, it's been a great thing.
And so you're there... What, every afternoon, but do...
Every Friday.
Every Friday every you do Friday. Movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And other things, too?
When big things happen, when luminaries die, when the Academy Awards happen, when there's big event-type news, I'll go on and I'll do something. But I started a website in 1999 and brought in all my friends and found critics, and we did that for a while, and now I'll still blog and put reviews up. But now I'm it's funny because I kind of retro-engineered this book based on my bullet point notes, and now I'm thinking I'm just going to write my reviews in this form and then pull the bullets for what I do on the radio. So I'm kind of writing the next one as I go.
So is this going to be an annual thing? Or maybe...
I would love it to be, actually. I kind of messed up by releasing it in October.
Because, why is that?
Well, because I understand that that's when books get released, that's a big retail time of year, but I do a fundraiser every year, and so I didn't have time to promote it or get into that until about January. And then in January, I thought, well, if I was putting the book out now, I could talk about Avatar, I could talk about Oscars, I could talk about all this exciting stuff. And I thought, I think that's when this book needs to come out. And so that's kind of my goal, is I'm looking at next spring.
Well, now, how did you get it published?
Well, I did it myself through a company called CreateSpace, which is an affiliation of Amazon.com. And I researched the heck out of this. And it's I really can't say enough things about the good things about the company. They've been easy to work with. You basically, you have to learn publishing from the ground up. Everything I I designed the entire book myself. You have to. And in the end, the split is generous. It's nice. It's kind of on you to learn how to promote it, hence my being here. it's been a great experience, and I'm kind of bitten by the bug. Now there's all these other things I want to write, and you know, before it used to be a lot harder to publish a book. Now you can do this. It's beautiful. A guy named Scott Moon designed the cover. Looks like any book in the store, and I'm very proud of that. And so now I think it's an exciting time for independent film and independent publishing, and I've always kind of been about that.
And we're talking with Dennis Willis about his book, Flick Nation. Well, so where can people find it?
They can find it at Amazon.com. They can find it at my website, DennisWillis.net, or FlickNation.net. And if it's ordered through me, I'll sign it, of course. It's been a great experience. I want to keep it going.
Well, let's talk about some of the other topics in mm-hmm. here. You have a section about Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you raised exactly the question I was just asking a friend of mine the other mm-hmm. day. What the hell is Blu-ray?
It's bad marketing, you know.
It
really is. It's catching on now, so this conversation is going to seem a little strange because Blu-ray just had a nice Christmas. When it came out, it was called Blu-ray, and the other one was called HD DVD. And I know what an HD DVD is because it says HD and DVD to me.
Exactly.
And that makes sense. A Blu-ray does not. It's based on what the laser is, but it was just bad marketing from the get-go. And it didn't exactly help that they introduced a format war, you know, and they always do this, VHS and Beta.
Right.
When DVD came out, there was the DivX format that confused people, and now there was this, and there's nothing better when you're launching a new technology than to have a format war to confuse customers. So now that all the dust is settled, the one that is the victor is called Blu-ray, and people still don't know what it's called.
But it's compatible with the older discs?
You can play the
DVDs.
Older discs. You can play the older discs, but you can't play Blu-rays on a DVD player. It's a special
right.
high definition. And it's beautiful. You know, it's only catching on now because they just lowered the prices. And that's the thing. When you've got a new technology, I think, you know, customers set the pace. And it's going to take $100 players and $20 movies, I think, to sway people. And that's what happened at Christmas.
Well, another topic in your introduction is piracy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have a bit of a controversial stand on that in that I don't think it's nearly as horrible as everybody says it is. You know, it's one of the byproducts of having the genie out of the bottle, as it were, the whole Napster fallout. And the curious thing about Napster and the music industry that I think has set the level for all of this is that the music industry was very slow to respond. And the movie industry hasn't been as slow to respond. They kind of saw that a lot of people have access to stuff online now in terms of music, and the movie industry responded with iTunes. And I think iTunes, in 2006, I believe, introduced downloadable movies, which was a great move toward kind of holding this whole thing off. But I think, you know, it's amazing how many people I meet on a regular basis who watch movies online, who download movies for free from pirate sites. It's a very commonplace thing. And yet at the same time, these same folks are at Target every week buying DVDs, paying their admission to see something on the big screen. I mean, I just said I Star Trek, I loved seeing that on the big screen. So if I had a choice of watching that on my computer in a fuzzy camera held, you know, or going to see it on the big screen, of course I'm gonna pick the best quality. But that's just me. Some people just want to see it. So right or wrong, you know, and a few examples in the book, you know, that Wolverine, for example, last April 1st, it was leaked onto the internet in a mostly completed version. I thought, this is going to kill this movie. Nobody's going to go see it now. It's going to be out 5 weeks, available for free, and nobody's going to pay to see it. Had like an $86 million opening weekend, made $300-some-odd million around the world. So riddle me that. You know, how does that happen? And I think it's enough people see part of it, they want to go and experience the whole thing.
Who are the big stars today?
Yeah, I have a problem with this one because the stars that they're pushing on us I think, are demographically what they want to hit, which is at 18 to 24. So we're getting all the Twilight kids pushed on us, and they were all at the Academy Awards.
I did see the opening where Steve Martin said to Alec Baldwin, and these kids don't even know who we are.
That's true. And it's kind of interesting because when I was growing up, and I'm 43 years old. When I was in high school, I knew who everybody was. And I don't think that, you know, when you think of music and popular culture, everybody goes back as far as their own lifetime, or maybe now even less. So I don't know who are the movie stars. I suppose the people who can open movies, according to Hollywood. But there's definitely ageism. There's definitely, when an actress hits a certain age, they go to TV and do great work. And it's not fair. And it just smacks of. I think it used to be an organic process. I think that the Humphrey Bogarts and the Harrison Fords. I think all these people were popular with the folks. I think now these are bean counter decisions, and our movie stars are being created by people who want to sell stuff at the corporate level more than an organic happening.
Okay, you know? Can't actors like Meryl Streep and George Clooney sell movies?
Absolutely, sure. But they've also been in the game quite a bit. If you come along now,
that's true. They're not the young.
No. And there's a lot of actors who are kind of grandfathered in, and as it were. But I think if you were starting out now and you were 30 years old, and you had 10 years to ply your craft, I think you would not be starting in a good place. And that's unfortunate, because in the end, we're creating movie fans. We're only looking at the quarterly bottom lines. We're not building careers anymore. And I'm especially critical of the music industry about this, but it's starting to seep into the film industry too.
So what directors do you like to watch?
Good question. I like directors who tend to have at some point in their life had a strong auteur streak. I like writer directors a lot. There's a lot of directors who are very competent at shooting studio films. They don't have to have written. But bring me something of yourself. You know what I mean? It's like, you could look at Steven Spielberg as having done it a long time, and he certainly had a style that he's one of the greats. Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds I liked a lot, I think, but he gets off on a bit of a tangent. I guess the only directors I really don't follow or like are the hacks, you know, the ones who make the same romantic comedies over and over. And if you look through the book, I mean, like I did, I can't think of any names off the top of my head, but it seemed to me the same people were directing the same kinds of films. If you can look at a director's filmography, and there's enough different things on there, and all done well, or at least all done in an interesting way, I'm a fan of that director. You know, give me somebody who's willing to play around with different genres, or like I said about Christopher Nolan, to take different genres and kind of mash them up and do something original with it, and I'm a fan of that person.
Well, it's been refreshing to have a chance to talk with you, and I look forward to the next installment.
Thank you. Thank you.
Of Flick Nation. Our guest is Dennis Willis. That's the title of his book, and his website is denniswillis.com.
.net.
.net.
Mm-hmm.
And
FlickNation.net.
FlickNation.net. And you can find his book at Amazon.com.
Thank you.
Book Talk is now available as a podcast. You can receive an MP3 of Book Talk every week free of charge for your MP3 player or home computer. Links to subscribe to all of KALW's local podcasts are available at kalw.org. And that's Book Talk for this week. This is Alan Farley. Thank you for listening.